Freedom of Thought in the Church, Should It Be Valued? Was presented by Jack Crabtree at the 2008 Oktoberfest Conference, entitled Freedom of Thought, Hollow Slogan, or Purposeful Practice. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2008. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
We're shifting gears in one sense, and in another sense we're not shifting gears at all. I want to talk about freedom of thought in the church. We've been talking about freedom of thought in the academy, but now we need to talk about freedom of thought in the church. I'm going to try to cut this short. So there is a handout coming around. I probably won't get to it in the lecture. I'll refer to it and just leave it to you to digest on your own if you're interested. We won't be talking about that here, so that's for you later. I want to start off just by making some observations. I don't feel like this is very profound because it's probably stuff that all of you know, but I just think it would be worth to remind ourselves that this is the reality. I want to talk about what goes on in our churches and in our Christian communities. What's the nature and character of what we experience as members of these communities? In general, the members of churches or Christian communities are discouraged from straying outside the boundaries of some acceptable Orthodox beliefs. Every church has their own boundaries. Some are narrower than others. Some are wider than others. But there comes a point where it's not allowed for you to step outside of those boundaries. If you step outside of those boundaries, typically the response, you'll get the message one way or the other that everyone else in the community thinks you have some kind of spiritual problem. Your relationship with God, your relationship with truth, your relationship, your faith is somehow being assaulted. And the reason you have problem with the things that we believe, the reason you're having questions about what we believe, is that there's something wrong with your faith. And in a variety of ways, all kinds of subtle social pressures will be put on you to come back in line, conform, believe, accept, submit. Different in all these things that I'm about to say, these will be true in varying degrees of different Christian communities and church communities. So I'm just describing experiences that I have had or people I know have had. These are all true, but they won't necessarily be all true of all Christian communities. But I'm just lumping them all together to give us a kind of portrait here. My experience in the church is that the prevailing attitude toward any kind of beliefs that are contrary to what we all say that we believe and accept, the contrary and prevailing attitude is fear. We're threatened. If someone doesn't toe the line and doesn't believe exactly as I believe, I'm threatened by that and I'm afraid of that. Churches don't typically strive to respond to unorthodox beliefs by refuting them. They typically respond by shunning them. So the churches don't typically invite debate. They may begin with debate. That would not be unusual because they, especially if they know you well enough and you don't seem like a heretic, you don't seem like a reprobate, you don't seem like someone who doesn't love God. So they want to bring you back in the fold, and they think all you need to do is to hear the arguments and sufficient arguments to bring you back in. Then they may be willing to debate long enough to bring you back in. But if you remain unpersuaded by their arguments, eventually you will be shunned. They isolate you. They marginalize you. You won't be allowed to teach in our particular church. They may tell you why. They may not tell you why, but you won't be allowed to teach either way. You won't be allowed to exercise any leadership in the church. You certainly will not be allowed to talk about or share your deviant perspective within the church. And ultimately, what that typically leads to is you eventually won't even be allowed to be in the community itself. You are dangerous. You are an unsafe person. And that message will be made clear to you, and you'll be isolated and pushed out. Church members in most of our communities are expected to discipline themselves to avoid even being exposed to contrary ideas. The ideas of heretics, the ideas of unbelievers, non-Christians, you shouldn't even read those books. That was a message that came through loud and clear in my childhood growing up in a Christian community, is that there are books that you shouldn't even read because they're, and oftentimes the shorthand would be, well, they're written by non-Christians, as if that was a reason not to expose your mind to them. Back earlier when I did a few tables for Gutenberg at various venues, parents of potential students would come up and they'd see the books that were out on the table, Darwin, Freud, Marx, Hume. You know, they'd look at that and they'd go, you let them read those things? And, you know, I've been away from that enough that it always sort of take me aback. Well, how are you going to know what they say if you don't read them? I mean, of course you let them read them. But it took me back to my childhood, and I realized, no, the rule is in our churches, you're not even supposed to read the ideas of people that are contrary to what we believe and what we're committed to and what we are confident is true. We're expected to read and expose ourselves only to ideas and arguments that are in harmony with our particular church doctrine. In our churches, investigation is not encouraged. It may be tolerated and may even be applauded if your investigation confirms the orthodoxy. They like people to invent new arguments that make you right, that make them right. So that might even be applauded. But if your investigation could at all conceivably call into question any aspect of our orthodoxy, it's not encouraged. Study and intellectual pursuit is spiritually dangerous to the typical Christian community. You don't typically think of the church as the place of dialogue. We don't promote it. We don't encourage it. We don't practice it. The church is the place for proclamation. It's thus saith the Lord. Here's what is true. Let me tell you. Here's what is true. And you don't expect a response. How do you know that? Is that really true? Give me your argument. Give me your evidence. That would seem really out of place. In the particular church that some of us go to, Reformation Fellowship, one of the most striking features to a visitor to our church, the thing they always comment on, is the question-answer period after the sermon. They say, you do what? That's not church. The fact that as a Bible teacher, I would have to be accountable in any way for what it is that I'm claiming, what it is that I'm proclaiming, and that I'd have to defend it, perhaps. It just doesn't seem like how churches are supposed to operate. We don't think of churches as a place of dialogue. The church does not expect disagreement among its members, and it doesn't respect disagreement among its members. Disagreement is viewed as a negative symptom in the community. There must be something wrong with us if there is disagreement among us. That's a lack of unity, is it not? Is the way we interpret it. So we discourage it. To the extent that it invariably occurs, and it will occur, but it's not allowed to show itself. We will never admit it. We need to hide it. We need to conceal it. Don't let it ever become visible to the members or the public out there, because that would be a sign of a lack of spiritual health. One of the ways it's discouraged is by discouraging intellectual discourse with respect to the Bible and theology at all. Theology in the Bible is only dealt with in the context of proclamation by an authorized teacher, but it's not the subject for dialogue between the members. You can employ your own personal reflection in the context of application. What does this truth that has been proclaimed to you and that we all know and agree on, how might we apply it? You can get original there. You can think for yourself there, perhaps, but you dare not think for yourself with respect to what the truth itself is. Anti-intellectualism, in other words, is the predominant cast of our church culture. The critics have been telling us this for years. The reality is they're actually right about that. We are an incredibly, deeply anti-intellectual culture, and that's what we've fostered, that's what we've encouraged, that's what we applaud. Typically, our churches view faith not as an intellectual journey, but as some sort of attainment. You come to faith. You now have faith. You have arrived at the truth. It's not that you're seeking truth. It's not that you're on the journey to truth. You already have it because you're one of us. As a member of our church, you have it. The quality that the church expects of its members is not to be seekers after truth, lovers of truth. The quality it expects is staying faithful, being loyal to our particular take on God and the faith. Typically, our churches view faith itself as not being fundamentally intellectual in nature. Faith is not an act of the mind, not a result of the intellect. It's something else, and we call it spiritual. Faith is a spiritual virtue, not an intellectual virtue or an intellectual achievement. So you can be anti-intellectual and still be a person of faith because they don't have anything to do with each other. That's our viewpoint. As I alluded to before, typically our churches view Christian unity as consisting of uniformity of belief. I don't think that's true. The unity that the Bible talks about is a common shared orientation to God and a shared commitment to the values and purposes and promises of God. It's that shared orientation from the inside of our being that makes us brother and sister, that puts us on the same page, that is the basis of our unity. But we've redefined that. No, you have to believe exactly the same things. You have to sign the same creeds and cite the same creeds. Typically, our churches view interpersonal harmony, actual social harmony, as indicative of Christian unity. The idea that we could be united in Christ and having a heated argument is completely foreign and alien to us. How could that possibly be true? Because it's that ease of social relationship is the Christian unity. And doctrinal disagreement disrupts that social harmony. So you can almost see a bumper sticker here. Doctrine divides. Reject theology. Just love one another. I mean, you've heard that a million times. Now, let's not get too deeply into doctrine. That's going to disrupt our unity. Well, it might disrupt the unity of conformity of belief, but does it really disrupt the unity that the Spirit produces in those people who are his children? I don't think so. But that's not how the way the church views it. Typically, we don't experience our churches as an intellectually stimulating environment. We might get other things out of church, aesthetically, emotionally, psychologically. There may be some benefit to us. But you don't usually go to church for intellectual stimulation. And I like what was said earlier. The worst things that we do for our children is to create an environment that doesn't encourage them to think for themselves because they are sitting ducks at the university. The academy may be hypocrites, but at least they espouse the right kind of academic freedom. They pretend like they're exercising academic freedom, even if they're not. We don't even pretend. We don't even think it's a virtue to have intellectual freedom within the confines of the church. So What human being in their right mind wouldn't find that more attractive than what we have created for them in our Christian cultures? We Christians have the reason, have the foundation, have the ground to create the most intellectually stimulating environments on the earth. And we don't. Instead, we experience our churches as intellectually repressive, just like our critics have maintained for a long time. So in general, what I'm suggesting with this brief portrait is that the church does not practice and it does not encourage freedom of intellectual pursuit. So it becomes really ironic when the movie that we saw last night that I fully, wholeheartedly, and completely endorse and support, the idea that the academy needs to be held responsible to practice academic freedom. But for us as the church to be lecturing the academy is pretty ironic in that regard, because we don't practice that within our own culture, and I think we need to look at ourselves as well. Now, there's a reason why a reason why Christian culture has been anti-intellectual. And I think the fundamental cause of it is what I'm going to call, let me coin a term here, what I'm going to call doctrinalism. In the past, I've used the word creedalism, but I have been misunderstood when I use that, so let me coin a different word. What I mean by doctrinalism is the belief that right doctrine or right belief is a necessary condition for salvation. If you don't get it right, you're going to hell. And that's the prevailing view in so many Christian traditions, some more than others, but for the most part, every Christian tradition has some semblance of doctrinalism at its heart. Now, let me be clear what I don't mean by doctrinalism. If we believe that the Bible's teaching can be summarized in explicit doctrinal statements, that's fine. That's not doctrinalism. That's only rational. Everything that we understand could probably be summarized in explicit statements, explicit propositions. That's just the way the mind works. Of course we should want to do that, desire to do that, attempt to do that, and continue to work on our summary and our formulation as we learn more and more. So I'm not criticizing that. That's not doctrinalism. The belief that there is an important correlation between what one believes and what one is open to believing and the moral spiritual condition of their heart, that's not false. That's not doctrinalism. Yes, much of what we believe reflects who we are and reflects the condition of my insides. That's a clear biblical teaching, I think. That's not doctrinalism. The issue is, how explicit is that correlation? Do you have to get all of your beliefs exactly right and get them right now in order to be saved, in order to have a heart that really longs to know God? Or is it a more general correlation that allows for growth and the freedom to see one's mistakes and correct one's mistakes and be on a journey of greater and greater and greater clarity about what the Bible teaches and what the truth of the gospel is? That's what doctrinalism forecloses on. It says you got to get it right, and you got to get it right now. If you don't believe what we believe, you're going to hell. Belief that it is important and right to hold true doctrinal beliefs instead of false doctrinal beliefs, that's not doctrinalism. I am as avid and enthusiastic about getting it right as any fundamentalist. When you disagree with me, I think you're wrong. And I think you better rethink it, and I think you better get it right. There's nothing wrong with that. We all should think that. We all should have that perspective, because truth is important. Doctrinalism is not believing that truth is important. Doctrine is saying is that not only is truth important, but God is unmerciful with respect to people who don't get the truth. And that's false. God is a God of mercy who is quite willing to take us in our bumbling efforts to become clear about the truth and is quite willing to embrace anyone who wants to get there, whether we have got there yet or not. So doctrinalism is that rigid kind of conviction that my salvation is completely and totally tied to my getting it right in my theology and my doctrines. Well, you can imagine then what the effects of doctrinalism are. Because they believe that if our beliefs are wrong, we are damned, look at the fear that strikes in our hearts, whether we feel it very consciously or not. There's that underlying fear that I might have it wrong. So what do we do in our churches? We just decide we don't have it wrong. It creates that dogma that we see so much characterizing Christians. We dogmatically assume that our beliefs are right. When anyone says otherwise, we get threatened because it's not a trivial issue. Eternal destiny depends on it. So don't you dare tell me I have it wrong. We can't be at ease when I don't know the answer to a question, and when I have to leave it an open question. You know, is the Calvinist right or is the Arminian right? I don't know yet. No, you can't not know yet. Because what if you get hit by a Mack truck before you know? You know, according to doctrinalism, you're going to be damned. So we are induced by our fear to close our minds around something, even if we have arbitrarily chosen sides in a doctrinal dispute, to close our minds around it and just believe. And then we baptize that just believing as a virtue. We call it faith. That's not faith, that's dogmatism. If doctrinalism is right, then it's intolerable to think of faith as a journey. It can't be a journey, because on a journey you haven't arrived yet and you keep changing places. So that on the intellectual map, if there's only one place to be that's going to get you salvation, if my faith is a journey, then I'm not saved yet. And our fear does not allow us to accept the idea that I'm not saved yet. So again, we're induced by our fear to dogmatically assume that by my faith, I have already attained the right and true beliefs. So the leadership of our churches, look what it does to them. Their job is to protect its members from being damned. Protect them and save them. So the church has to do that. The church has to ensure that everyone in our church accepts what our church knows is the truth. How do you do that? You have to ensure conformity of belief to our orthodoxy, whatever that might be. And if you must coerce and manipulate to get them to conform, then so be it. It's for a good cause. I'm saving their souls. Never mind that I am dissing their humanity, but I'm saving their souls. So believing that the boundaries of orthodoxy are the boundaries of salvation itself, the leadership of the church does not and cannot allow there to be any freedom to think outside the boundaries of that orthodoxy. So that's why we are so anti-intellectual. That's why we can't dare allow freedom of thought in the churches. But the problem is, doctrinalism is wrong. That's not what the Bible teaches. Unless I'm wrong. We are saved, according to the Bible, not because we have our beliefs right. We're saved because we have what the Bible calls a good heart. The Bible doesn't exclude the possibility that somebody could be wrong about what they believe and nonetheless be saved, because they have a heart that is rightly oriented toward their Creator and toward the purposes and things of their Creator. Their soul is right, their person is right, their being is right, but they've made some mistakes intellectually. Why might they make some mistakes intellectually? Well, one, because human beings make intellectual mistakes. I mean, we just do. I'll talk more about that in a second. And then secondly, much of what we believe is shaped and formed by culture and by the various psycho-emotional effects of our experience and our culture on us. Some things are just unthinkable to us at this particular point in my life. I dare say for a lot of the scientists that we've been talking about who are Darwinists, their life experience, the pressures on them, the culture that they live in, ID is simply unthinkable to them. You have to be an idiot to believe that kind of stuff. I mean, that is so deeply ingrained in them that they can't even get past the obstacle of that to actually consider rationally and philosophically the evidence. Well, the same thing happens in the churches. You find me at a certain time and place in my life where there are some ideas that are just unthinkable to me. That just can't possibly be right. I've told people a number of occasions, I just have this distinct memory of me as a college student, as an undergraduate, coming out of a conservative Bible-believing church, going to a very liberal secular university, which was a mind-bending experience. But as you might imagine, I had my dogmatic moments trying to confront that culture. And there were actually Bible teachers that I heard teach that I completely and immediately wrote off. They're just a liberal. You know, they don't know what they're talking about. They don't really believe the Bible. They can't even really be a believer. So I shouldn't even be listening to them because they don't even believe this stuff. Well, I have this faint recollection of, I didn't listen very closely, but I think what they were teaching back then is what I am teaching today. And I've often said that if I were an undergraduate today listening to me, I wouldn't listen to me. You know, I wouldn't trust me. I wouldn't be listening to me. Well, why? It's because I wasn't ready. It was what they were saying to me back then was just unthinkable to me. It was so foreign, so unfamiliar, so alien that I didn't even know how to process it. I didn't even know how to evaluate it. So when someone fails to believe because they have been set up by everything in their experience and their culture and their psycho-emotional map to not even be able to entertain the possibility of the truth, then of course they're not going to embrace the truth. But is it because their heart is wrong? Is it because their heart is not oriented toward God? They don't want to know God and they don't love God? Not necessarily. This is just a snapshot of them at a point in the journey on their life. Give them 15 years. And that love for God and that love for truth and that love for righteousness is going to take them closer and closer and closer to what's actually true. And what they reject today, they will be embracing the next decade. So doctrinalism says, in the meantime, they're damned. I think the Bible says, in the meantime, they are right on track. God is a magnet drawing them to himself, and they're on their way to God, to the truth from God. The objection that you'll raise is, but the Bible says you have to believe the truth to be saved. But two questions. Yes, it does say that. I mean, Jesus makes some very, what seem very cut and dried statements that if you reject me, the Father will reject you. If you believe in me, you will have life. So the objection would be, why is that not obvious to you, Jack? But the question is, when Jesus says that, when the apostles say what they say, are they speaking absolutely from an absolute standpoint, or are they simply describing what is typically the case, and not just typically the case, but typically the case in their context, in the context in which they were writing and speaking? I mean, we have to remember, when Jesus and the apostles were writing and speaking, there was no church. There were no social and political benefits from being a Christian. There was no economic benefit to being a Christian. All the reasons why people could become and stay Christians today were not at play when Jesus and the apostles are speaking and teaching. Why did the people who believed the gospel message in the earliest generation, why did they believe it? For one and only one reason. Because they were convinced that it was true, and if I want to be in touch with the truth about reality, I guess I just have to acknowledge the truth and I have to bow to the truth. What did it get them? Dead, poor, imprisoned, beaten. It bought them nothing but grief. But what else were they to do? Because it was the truth. What happens today? Becoming a Christian, you get a whole new set of people that you can sell things to. You get a social network where you have people to socialize with that you like, for a set of friends. You find acceptance. You can build a little empire in some churches. You can be have a lot of power and prestige and honor. There's all kinds of benefits, worldly benefits, evil desires can take you into the fold of our churches today. So we are in a situation where you can believe what's true, but for all the wrong reasons and motives and ground, and therefore be an evil person who nonetheless embraces true beliefs. But we're also in a position where you can be rightly oriented to your Creator, wanting to know Him, seeking to love Him, and yet for a variety of reasons, not quite get your theology right and not get your doctrine right. It's not what we believe that ultimately determines whether we're saved. It's who we are at the core of our being and how we're oriented toward God. So my perspective on what on why there should be freedom of thought in the church goes something like this. We were made to be knowers. God created us to, with a desire to know, a passion to know, an obligation to know. I think there's a moral dimension to knowledge. To avoid knowledge or certainly to suppress knowledge is just simply immoral. It's wrong. But while knowledge is possible, and while God created the resources that we have to know things to be a competent process, it's not infallible. So we make mistakes. And that's true of Christians just as well as non-Christians. We're finite and fallible, and we are sinful, even as Christians. And the combination of our fallibility as creatures and our sinfulness as rebellious creatures, that's a powerful combination that makes us get a lot of things wrong. But nevertheless, knowledge remains possible because human knowing, by its very nature, is a self-correcting process. I may make mistakes, but I have the intellectual resources to realize when I have made mistakes and try to fix my mistakes. So knowledge is always a process of growing clearer and clearer in my understanding, getting better and better in my grasp of what is actually the case. And that's just the way human knowledge works. Never has worked any differently, and it never will work any differently. So it's a process toward the truth. It's an intellectual journey. But what that means, since it's an intellectual journey, is different human beings will inevitably be at different stages in their journey toward the truth. We're not all going to be in the same place. We have different life experience. We have different data. We have different prejudices built into us. All kinds of differences that put obstacles in our paths from arriving at the truth. And what I can see, you may not be able to see. And what you see so clearly, I may be blind to. So we're going to be at a different place in the way we put our theology together. Therefore, every individual, if we're in a Christian community, every individual in our community should be granted the freedom to be in process, to be in that very process. They should have the freedom to identify and correct the mistakes in their belief system. We should expect that we will not all be at the same place, and therefore we shouldn't expect agreement in our Christian communities. Why would we expect that if we're at different stages? Disagreement is not something unhealthy in our communities. It's actually very healthy. Artificial agreement is way more unhealthy than is natural disagreement. So, because different people are at different places and have a different perspective and a different outlook and different things are persuasive to them, dialogue with one another is going to be a tremendous aid to each and every one of our intellectual journey an aid to us on our intellectual journey. By you coming along and seeing things differently than I do, it awakens me to the fact that maybe there's another way of looking at it. Now, I could just blow you off. Well, you're going to hell and you're wrong, so I don't have to think any further about it. But hopefully, I will be sensitive enough to that disagreement to go, okay, now why am I confident of what I believe and I reject what they believe? Why do I do that? And one of two things is going to happen. Either I'm going to become clearer about why I believe what I believe and all the more confident in what I believe, or I'm going to go, oh, I've been a little hasty here. There really are some things I'm not taking into account. And in the end, I may actually come to realize, wow, they're right and I'm wrong. And I'm the better off for it. I have grown intellectually because they have got me out of the rut that I was in, out of the dogma I was in, and got me thinking along different lines that actually led me closer to the truth. So it's by our sharpening one another's minds through dialogue that we are going to be better off in our faith. But healthy dialogue presupposes freedom of thought, the freedom to hold intellectual convictions without being subject to social, physical, or financial harm. So we, more than anybody on the earth, because truth is so vitally important to us, so foundational to everything our faith is all about, we of all people should be champions of that freedom of thought, it seems to me. I was going to contrast why we believe in freedom of thought as opposed to postmodernism. That's an entirely different story. We don't believe in freedom of thought because we don't think there is any truth and because all perspectives are valid. All the stuff that would be current in our culture today, that's not where we're coming from if we're Christians. But nonetheless, we may have a different foundation for freedom of thought than they do, but it is freedom of thought that we have a foundation for. It's a biblical virtue, I would argue. But I won't develop that any further. I'm going to get you out of here almost on time then. What has been handed out, and if you didn't get one, we'll try to find you a copy, is what then would a Christian community look like if it actually practiced freedom of thought? And I have a chart there where I list two kinds of communities, what I call a radical biblicist community, and what I mean by that is if I am committed to the authority of the Bible and only the Bible, I'm not committed to the authority of a creed or a doctrinal statement or somebody's definition of orthodoxy, but I really am trying to understand the Bible and the Bible alone as that which is giving me the truth, and that's my own personal commitment. So I've outlined what I think a community would look like if it was made up of nothing but radical biblicists on the one hand, and then what does a community look like that is committed to some kind of orthodoxy, as defined by a tradition or a creed or something like that. And I've tried to show the contrast there. So I'll just let you look at that and digest that on your own. And if you have questions, you can raise them. You can talk to me or raise it later in the discussion session. I may be too idealistic. This picture that you have on here may not work in real life, but it's a really cool idea. And I would love to see churches become more and more and more intellectually stimulating environments where dialogue happens, education, real and true education happens, and we work on equipping one another to be people who are going to learn more and more and more about our Creator and about what our Creator is doing in the world. Thank you.